What's up, family? You are tuned into Law and Disorder, a podcast where we expose the cracks in our system, agitate for resistance, and collectively build a new world in which all of us can thrive. From KPFA Radio and the Pacifica Network, I'm your host, Kat Brooks.
What's up, family? You're listening to Law and Disorder. I'm your host, Kat Brooks. El Salvador's president has offered to house what are being referred to as violent criminals in the United States, even those with U.S. citizenship, in his mega prison, Sekolt. Joining us to discuss is Ana Piquer, America's director at Amnesty International. Good morning, Ana.
Good morning. Thank you.
I think context here is super important, right? So let's start by talking about El Salvador's president, Nayib Bukele, who took office in 2019. Who is he? Where did he come from?
Well, Nayib Bukele is an atypical president in many ways. He has recently been reelected in a very questioned election, even if it was constitutional that he could be reelected. And he was elected on the promise of combating the gang violence that was rife in El Salvador, which was a very real problem for the country at the time. And since March 2022, he began a state of exception that has been renewed and renewed over and over again until today. That's basically no longer an exception. It has been completely normalized. And that state of exception came with mass arrests, thousands of people. The calculations, it's around 84,000 people who have been arrested with no due process and incarcerated under very, from the point of view of human rights, very concerning conditions. We have documented even deaths in prison. Local organizations have estimated that deaths in prison have been around 300 people. And so it's a very, from the human rights perspective, it's a very, very concerning situation that the president has led the country.
I want to walk through actually some of the consequences that are detailed on your website in the article that says El Salvador, 1,000 days into the state of emergency security, which is in quotation marks, at the expense of human rights. You already addressed the in-custody deaths. Can you talk about the sweeping police roundups? Like, who's getting caught up in this web of criminality?
What we have documented based on several visits to the country and working with local organizations is that, in a way, the same people that were before affected by gang violence are now being affected by these policies. The sweeping arrests have been done mostly in more impoverished places in the country, affect specifically people who have tattoos, who lived in communities that were before controlled by gangs. So it's basically the same group of people that before were victims by the gangs and now are victims of state violence. In fact, we have said several times that somehow the government replaced gang violence with state violence. And it's affecting specifically people who live in poverty, people who are in the most vulnerable communities within the country.
Can you also talk about the ways in which the judicial system has been co-opted by Bukele's administration in this state of exception or emergency?
Yeah, he took several measures that ended up, basically what he did is replace most of the judiciary with people that are loyal to him. And that has become, and that also happened with Congress, by the way. He also controls Congress mostly. So at this point, the executive branch, the government, doesn't have actual oversight. And that has become a huge issue also for civil society. The government is operating with no balances, checks and balances within the government, within the state. And on the other hand, there is very little or basically no transparency regarding what the government is doing in many things, including the security plan. Bukele has announced he is developing a plan to combat violence, gang violence, but nobody knows what that plan is. He talks about, we are in the new phase of the plan, but nobody knows which those phases even are, or if he's making them up as he goes. So it goes even beyond the judiciary. He has made sure to have very little checks and balances, very little oversight, and that leaves the victims of human rights violations in an impunity loop that is very complex.
And thirdly, Anna, another thing that's mentioned on the website in that article is an adaptation of torture policies within the prison.
Yes.
Can you talk about that?
Yes, and that's the most alarming part of that is that it's not something that is being done covertly. On the contrary, it's absolutely overt. The prisons are, and especially even the very modern, supposedly modern CECOT, the Center for Confinement of Terrorism that President Bukele showed to the media so proudly, is basically designed to mistreat prisoners. There is an open policy of that has been, the director of the prison system and different authorities have proudly said that the objective of the prison system is to mistreat prisoners. And so it's blatant. The level of mistreatment and in cases of torture is something that is pervasive and that is part of the design. It's not something that is being kept hidden, but it's openly part of the design of the prison system during the Bukele governments.
So given all of this and his history and his present course of action, your reaction, Amnesty International's reaction and concerns when Marco Rubio announces that Bukele has offered the United States a plan to pay to house violent criminals in SECOT. What could go wrong?
Yeah, that's the question. First to say, given all this context, if this agreement went forward, which goes way beyond something like a safe third country agreement, it's a completely different thing. It would imply to be willing to run the risk of putting these people as victims of this cruel system that's designed to mistreat prisoners. And so, first of all, it's risking the placing people to be victims of human rights violations. And at the same time, it's validating this system that's designed to mistreat prisoners. It would be validating it because they are willing to send people there, because they would be paying to send people there. That's financing a system that is in itself, by design, in violation of human rights. So it's, in principle, it's absolutely problematic, and it could imply further human rights violations. And on the other hand, it can make it worse, because on the system, the prison system in El Salvador is already hugely overcrowded. Sending even more people into the system would only make overcrowding worse. And in addition to that, you would have people that are basically incarcerated in isolation. It's people that will not be in their own country, so they won't have contact with their families, with their communities, with their lawyers. It would make them completely isolated, and that is against any human rights rule, the Mandela rules on treatment of prisoners. It wouldn't be viable from a human rights perspective.
You know, in addition to the human rights violations, one of the other things that sort of hit me, and I'm wondering if you have thoughts on, is how Bukele's offer would intersect with Trump's immigration executive orders, including the one where even if you are only accused of a crime, you can be held and deported.
Exactly. And there is an absolute correlation. And also because among Trump's executive orders and changes in policies, there is a clear intention of doubling down on criminalizing people who are in an irregular situation as migrants. The intention of using the criminal law as a way to persecute people who are not in a regular situation as migrants. So if these people, for example, are convicted and then sent to El Salvador, to a jail that is designed as a hyper security prison for terrorists and incarcerated along with people who may have committed serious crimes, and also subject to gross human rights violations that shouldn't apply to anyone. So there's several layers of problematic issues, especially if it's used as part of the system to criminalize people who are not in a regular situation in the U.S. as migrants.
If you're just tuning in, family, you're listening to Law and Disorder. I'm your host, Kat Brooks, and we're in conversation with Ana Piquet, America's director at Amnesty International. We're talking about El Salvadoran President Nayib Bukele's offer to house what are being referred to as violent criminals from the United States in his mega prison, Sekolt. I want to go back, Ana, to how this is impacting the people, right? Over the last weekend, I was talking to a friend of mine who's from El Salvador, and she went back to visit her family who are left-leaning, and she asked them, right, about the human rights violations and the crackdown on crime, and they said, we'll take it. I can ride the bus. I can walk down the street, right? Like, so things were so bad that people are willing to sell their souls for the illusion of safety.
And that's something we have heard several times as well. The feeling that, and it's real, the feeling that people have today that they can walk freely in the streets in places where before they couldn't, it's real. The thing is, this was not the only solution. First, this was, politicians shouldn't put people in the need to choose that. To choose between human rights and their security. And the second part of that is that there is no security without human rights. There are people who are today incarcerated who did absolutely nothing. And there is absolutely nothing they can do because there's no independent judicial system. They were not subject to a due process of law. And they are being today victims of the system. So it's a choice we should not have to be making. That's one thing. And the third thing is that this is not a solution that will work in the long run. There, even in his campaigning, in the start of his first government, Nayib Bukele talked about attending to the root causes of the violence. What brought about the fact that the gangs were able to be so powerful. What happened there in terms of poverty, in terms of the society, in terms of the history of corruption and impunity? That has not been addressed. All he did was to incarcerate over 80,000 people, regardless of whether they were criminals or not, many times just because they had tattoos. And today they have the highest incarceration rates in the world. That's not a sustainable solution. It's solving something today, maybe. People do feel the difference, but it's not something that will work out in the future. And if something like the agreement with the U.S. goes forward, where even President Bukele said, this would solve our financial problem because it would make our prisoner system sustainable, basically what we're doing is keeping all these people in jail and not solving the actual issue of why the violence became so rampant in El Salvador. So we understand the point of view, of course, but it's a much more complex situation. And this is a very short-term solution to something that is way more difficult.
I mean, you can just look at the United States and know that, right? So prior to this particular moment here, we incarcerated more people than anywhere else in the world, including, you know, some countries combined. And yet we remain one of the top 10 most violent places on the planet to live. So we know it doesn't work. The data says it doesn't work. And yet in this current moment, we're watching the tough on crime, lock them up and throw away the key strategy that we very much, you know, here in America, and what we saw, you know, during the 80s and 90s and the criminalization of addiction and the promise again of safety. It made us all less safe, right? Our families were torn apart. Folks went to the most violent institutions in the world and came out, you know, not great.
Yeah, that's our concern. As I say, it may feel like a very short, like a good solution right now, but it's a short-term solution. It's not something that will work in the long run. And if root causes are not addressed, it's the same with drugs. It's the same with any other form of organized violence. if you don't address the root causes, it will come back. And it makes things worse in the long run.
Yeah, and often come back with a vengeance, yes. Anna, talk about the alignment between and or relationship between Donald Trump and Nayib Bukele.
Well, they're both very, these kind of strong men leaders that pose themselves as not the traditional politicians. So, of course, there's a relationship there. And also, they have both, sadly, been seen as, in a way, as models, as something to replicate. And that is something that for us is concerning. How the relationships between them will play out, they have seemed to be aligned in many ways. They both participated in different meetings even before President Trump got elected, I think. And but we'll see how these two strongmen really are able to relate to each other. And our concern from Amnesty International and what we would like to address is how we avoid the copycat effect, how we avoid that people see what they are doing as something to imitate and as something to admire in a way, and show to what extent what they are doing is harmful. And it's harmful for so many people at a very personal level sometimes. And so that's what we're trying to push and what we're trying to make visible is the harm that they're doing and how that harm can be long lasting if we don't resist it. Now.
Anna, I want to ask you a broader question, right? So on our show, we track the swing, the pendulum swinging to the right here in America, but also across the globe, right? If you look at the rise of the right party in France, you look at what's happening in Italy, where I was recently, and it was a very different experience as a Black body walking through those streets than it was 20 years ago. If you look at the rise of white supremacist, organizations globally, it's not just here, right? You look at what's happening on the border of Ukraine. What's your analysis of this moment that we're in, and what is Amnesty International? I heard you say the copycat effect, but it feels like that's already in play. That is what, people are reclaiming their whiteness and then folks of color, because conditions are so bad, are saying, I don't care what happens as long as I feel safe.
Yeah, it is a very difficult moment. And it's something that in Amnesty and in general, in the human rights movement, I think it's a moment of big reflection in terms of why people stop feeling that human rights is something that is useful for them. It's, in a way, how did it happen that other concerns, or that certain concerns addressed in certain ways, seem more appealing? What happened that we, maybe as a human rights movement and maybe certain more progressive politicians weren't really addressing those very pressing concerns and very real concerns. So I think it is also a moment of reckoning and a moment of finding new ways to resist. We have been discussing a lot about an idea of re-engineering hope, of how we need to think again about what hope means. How do we visualize a different future, and how can we really show that different future with human rights is something that benefits everyone? And so it's not an easy question, and I don't think nobody has a very clear answer at this time. But as you say, the copycat effect is something that had already happened, and where these narratives have permeated, it's like a very, very strong backlash in terms of, as you said, of whiteness, of people who are or have been and still are historically in spaces of privilege are somehow now claiming some form of victimhood, which is very complicated to navigate in what we were used to doing. So it's a moment to get creative. It's a moment to think out of the box, to think what have we not done? How can we do things differently to show that this is not a world where everyone can live freely and happily? This is not a world, this is a world that's harming a huge amount of people. And we can try to build a world where everybody can have their rights and their freedom and their happiness somehow guaranteed or at least protected. And that's something we really need to start discussing and continue discussing and continue creating and continue resisting and re-engineering whatever we need to do to resist this.
Anna, I am so grateful that you ended on that note, right? I'm also an organizer in addition to this, and the level of apathy or resignation or, you know, we're all doomed, is really hard to be in conversation around, right? People have lost hope. So I love this idea of re-engineering hope. Thank you for that. And thank you so much for joining us this morning.
No, thank you very much for the invitation.
You are listening to Law and Disorder. I'm your host, Kat Brooks, and we've been in conversation with Anna Piquer, America's director at Amnesty International.
You've been listening to Law and Disorder, a podcast where we expose the cracks in our system, agitate for resistance, and collectively build a new world in which all of us can thrive. That's it for this episode, family. You can find more information about topics and guests in this episode's show notes. Law and Disorder is produced at KPFA. That's listener-supported radio on the Pacifica Network. The show is produced by Jesse Strauss and hosted by me, Kat Brooks. Our theme music was composed by Steve Raskin of Fort Knox 5. If you like what you heard, please follow us on social media at Law and Dis, that's D-I-S, and subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts. Feel free to holler at us about something you heard or send us a show idea at lawanddisorder@kpfa.org. You can also find our content live at 8 a.m. weekdays on KPFA. That's 94.1 FM in the Bay Area. Our show and all of KPFA's programs are funded exclusively by you, the listener. And if you're in a position to support us, please donate today at kpfa.org. Take care of yourself and take care of each other. We all we got, fam.